Week 13 of the NFL season has come and gone. We saw Earl Thomas, major injury, starts tweeting about retirement. What is up with that? Eric Berry getting all the points in Atlanta in a big Chiefs win. The Gronkless Patriots look pretty much like the Gronk Patriots. And the Raiders, always interesting. Another big comeback win. All that and much, much more in the MMQB 10 Things podcast. Hey, it's Gary and Andy from the 10 Things podcast here, and we want to tell you about our friends at Mack Weldon. Andy, do you enjoy a good pair of sweatpants?
Like nothing else. Like, I think every snap of football I've watched this season, I have been wearing sweatpants while watching.
Well, that's the thing. With Mack Weldon, you can not only get the sweatpants, you get the hoodie, you get the underwear, you get the socks. Unbelievably comfortable stuff. Ensconce yourself in Mack Weldon. Because I can tell you right now, I'm wearing them, and they are better than whatever you are wearing right now. Mack Weldon believes in smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. I mean, it could not be easier. If you have some non-tech-savvy folks, maybe parents, grandparents, doing your holiday shopping, send them to MackWeldon.com because it's online shopping done as easy as it could possibly be. And like I said, the stuff I have on looks great and feels great. Mack Weldon has the most comfortable underwear, socks, undershirts, hoodies, and sweatpants that you will ever wear. All of their products are naturally antimicrobial. That's a very big word. It means it eliminates odor, so you can wear it all day. Wear it to the gym, then wear it on a date. Wear it while you sit around and watch football all day. You will look good. You will smell good. What else could you possibly want? But here's the best part. Mack Weldon wants you to be comfortable, so if you don't like your first pair, you can keep it, and they will still refund you, no questions asked. So go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your order using the promo code MMQB.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling.
Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. We are through week 13. I am Gary Gramling. I am here with Andy Benoit, and both of us wore proper dress code attire, so we are both going to start this game today.
Yeah, and that's a weird one, isn't it? I imagine we will be hearing more about that topic later in the week or at some point. It's not going to become a big deal, the Cam Newton not playing the first snap, but it's not going to just go away quietly either. That's going to be one Ron Rivera has to talk about Monday morning, and I think we ought to wait to hear what he has to say publicly first.
It's just it's incredible that it ended up being a interception, of all things. The safest throw possible, and Mike Tolbert manages to deflect the thing to a defender.
Well, did you feel that was completely on Tolbert? My sense, and I'd have to go back and watch it, in the flow of that, I felt like there was a lot of heat on that ball, and
yes,
the precision wasn't where it needs to be. It's the easiest throw possible, but it was not the easiest catch possible.
Those are both true, but to turn it into an interception was a bit much.
Yep.
That was too much, Mike Tolbert. Just knock it down. Take
knock
a second
it down.
And
it's a ball to the flat. The other thing that's interesting is, and I think Derek Anderson is a competitor. I think he takes the game very seriously. I think something he does when he's a little distraught is he smiles and laughs kind of in chagrin. But on TV, it looks like, I remember a few years ago when he was quarterbacking the Cardinals against the Niners, he got caught on the sideline laughing in a blowout. And John Gruden pointed it out, and there was a little bit of a deal with that, and Anderson was sensitive about it, but Derek Anderson's facial expressions do not help him out in terrible situations.
Yeah. No, that's it's a bit unfair. I know that. It's the angry laughter. Nervous, angry laughter.
Ah. Yeah.
Number one.
Well, let's jump into this thing, and we're actually starting right there with topic one. This is Seattle shellacking the Carolina Panthers. And I think we have basically delved as deep into the Carolina Panthers as we will in this week's show. But let's talk Seattle Seahawks and specifically the absence of Earl Thomas. He is going to be out for, it sounds like, well, certainly the end of this season. And he sent a very bizarre and cryptic tweet, which has to be against you know, whatever league rules there are about tweeting mid-game. But he tweeted, "This game has been so good to me. No regrets. A lot is running through my mind, including retirement. Thanks for all the prayers." Now let's operate under the assumption that he will be back in 2017. He broke a bone in his leg, in case you missed it, during a it was a collision midfield, a hospital ball that Cam Newton threw over the middle, and, well, two Seahawks ended up injuring each other. But this defense without Earl Thomas, they didn't have him last week, and it's not quite the same unit. And you and I had talked a little bit during the offseason about how Earl Thomas had never missed a game, and is he the most valuable piece of this defensive backfield? Because we saw a year ago they were okay without Cam Chancellor. But now we're going to see what they do without Earl Thomas long term.
And he's an interesting player because I think we all agree he's the best free safety in football. His range and his football IQ, and football IQ helps your range, by the way. It's not just being a fast guy. It's knowing where to run. So you have that element. The interesting part is free safeties really don't impact plays as often as other positions, and that's why there aren't very many of them in the Hall of Fame. And we certainly don't see a lot of the plays when they do impact a play because they're not on screen or it's very nuanced. So he can be a hard one to judge, and I think there's a tendency to say, well, they were fine with Stephen Terrell in there last week. I know that Terrell, they had the big touchdown, that Cam Newton threw the touchdown again after Terrell came in. I'm not sure that was completely on him, though. That was a too high coverage.
Yeah.
But the point is, I think we can forget about Earl Thomas because we don't see him on screen. But every time I've talked to Seahawks coaches, one of the questions I've always liked to ask them, and it sounds a little fanboyish, but it's an important one from a football standpoint because Seattle runs such a very basic, straightforward scheme. So they're an execution defense. And so I always like to ask their coaches, which guy on that defense is most valuable to you? Because your answer to that question kind of speaks to your overall football philosophy. It's if you say Michael Bennett, then what you're saying is pass rushing is most valuable to me, or Cliff Averill, which is a realistic answer. If you say Richard Sherman, you're saying boundary corner is most valuable, and you get a sense for how coaches build their schemes. The answer I've got, most of those coaches can't bring themselves to answer it, but the one name that tends to come up is Earl Thomas, and they say it's not so much everything he does, it's the comfort level that a guy like Earl Thomas gives you as a coach. So coaches like him because a coach, half his job is just figuring out how not to get beat on defense. And when you have Earl Thomas back there, you feel so much more at ease with the idea of not getting beat. And I think you're probably a little more comfortable doing other things, taking chances, asking other guys to play faster. Earl Thomas is the ultimate security blanket, and now that element's going to be gone from Seattle's defense.
Yeah, and look, I know you're not into symbolism, Andy, but there was some symbolism to the fact that Thomas goes out in the very first play is the 55-yard touchdown, the only points that the Panthers scored in this game. But I want to refocus on the other side of the ball for a moment because the Seahawks were terrible last week in Tampa. They ended up with they scored 5 points in that game, and obviously they only scored 3 of those points because 2 came on a defensive safety, 245 net yards. This week, Sunday night against Carolina, they rolled up 534, including 240 on the ground. Thomas Rawls, most of them. Tyler Lockett, to start the second half, had that little end-around 75-yard TD run. How much did they get right as far as their offense goes? And do you feel good about this unit when you look ahead now?
Oh, absolutely. I felt good about them even after last week. Some teams just have bad games. It happens. And every year, when you watch every game, what's occurred to me is about once a year, a team's going to have a face plant game. They're gonna poop the bed, and that's what Seattle did on offense last week.
Thanks for keeping it PG, by the way.
Yes, you're welcome. That was a road game across the country on the other side, and at an earlier window. It was a 4 o'clock, but to Seattle, that's 1 o'clock. This was a home game in their very loud arena at 5 o'clock, which is my guess is that's a perfect time to start a football game if you're a professional player. You have all day to get your body ready. So it's not apples to apples, but the point with Seattle's offense, there's 2 things that have happened lately. Russell Wilson's gotten healthier. Everybody knows that. And I think the blessing in disguise with his ankle injury was that he had to learn to play from the pocket, which he'd started doing a year ago, but he had to continue to build on that, and he did. So they played very well. He ought to be in the MVP discussion, Gary. He played very well when his ankle was hurt, and now he's back, and we're seeing the full dimension of Russell Wilson, but he's not relying on those legs like he used to. They're not a crutch for him anymore. They're a weapon, and almost exclusively a weapon. So that's the one thing. The other thing is Thomas Rawls looks like he's giving them a foundational running game, and what he has that their other running backs did not is a very distinct ability to create his own yards. He has some lateral movement skills. It's not what his game's based on, but his violent running mixed with his light feet, he's a tough runner to face. And then just coincidentally, their offensive line's playing better as well with Rawls back.
And for any college football nerds out there, I couldn't believe George Farmer was out on the field today. Though I guess he was active last week, had his first career touch in this game. George Farmer was like the wide receiver recruit back, I guess that would have been like 6 or 7 years ago now, the Odell Beckham class. He was the guy everyone wanted. Went to USC, just never panned out. Now he's in Seattle and playing running back.
And with the way this season's gone, he might get a chance to start at some point. They've been cycling through guys. I hope he doesn't, because I want to see Thomas Rawls be the guy down the stretch. This Seahawks team is very well put together, and they are the team. I know Dallas is on top of the world right now. Seattle, and I've thought this for several weeks, they're the team I would least want to face in the postseason.
Yeah. Nope. I would agree with that.
Number two.
Well, let's go on to topic number two, Andy. And that is, we're going to have more safety talk. It's a very safety show today. Eric Berry puts on a show in Atlanta, and you know, there was some, this was a homecoming for him. There was a lot of emotional tie-ins with this game for him. So it was, you know, there was a certain sweetness to him having such a big game. But he had two monster plays, had a pick six, and then I'm sure everyone has seen it at this point, but the Falcons had taken a one-point lead, went for two to stretch the lead to three, and Berry picked it off and took it back for a pick two, if you will. And I know you will, because everyone on the internet already wrote that, and I'm just repeating it.
I like it.
But
I like it.
Let's talk a little Eric Berry, who, I mean, look, he was in the contract dispute this past offseason, and, I mean, man, he has been a monster this season.
He's having a very nice year, and he's in a position to make more flash plays. A few years ago, when I think he was all pro, maybe he wasn't. His best season was about, I think 2014 was his best season, if I recall. It may have been 2013, actually. But he got good in man-to-man coverage against tight ends, and that was a weakness of his at the very beginning of his career. And so he had more man-to-man assignments. Well, they have not used him in that capacity as much this year. He still does it at times, but they have other guys. They're very deep at safety. They're versatile. They're comfortable with a lot of guys doing a lot of things. And so they're not always putting Berry in man-to-man on tight end. So if you're not playing man-to-man, you become the defender with eyes that are free to read the field and roam the ball. And that's what he's done. Zone defenders always are going to have more interceptions than man defenders, because zone defenders have their eyes on the ball, on the quarterback. They're reading things around them. Berry is getting, he's not a zone defender in that scheme. It's a man matchup type of scheme, but he's getting to play more like a zone defender, and he's doing very well with it.
Yeah. I mean, look, he will be a free agent again after the season, and he is going to get a massive payday. I think he's got to make more than Tyrann Mathieu at this point. I'm sure he's going to ask for more.
Yes, he should. And that's not to say that he's more valuable than Mathieu, but typically the latest contract's the most valuable.
Exactly, you build on top of it.
Yeah, and the safety is in a weird position right now, because it's a position in transition. It is an extremely valuable position in the NFL, and we've seen that more teams are taking safeties with Carl Joseph first round, Keanu Neal first round. Those guys are having very nice season in Byard and in Tennessee. A lot of young safeties on the rise, and that's because the safety positions become so versatile, flexible. It's really the only position that's a direct answer for tight ends, and tight ends are the mismatch makers in today's league. So it's going to be hard to figure out Berry's contract, because the position's undervalued right now. Coaches know how valuable it is, but front office guys are going to pretend that they've never heard about that. And the difference with Matthew, he got his deal done in the middle of the season, or he wasn't up against the clock. He had time on his deal left, I believe. So there was no pressure with his contract. There's pressure with Barry's contract. I would imagine that will be a harder negotiation this offseason.
Yeah, something to watch this summer. This winter, this March.
It might be summer. It went into summer this year.
It did. Eric Berry scoring points for the Chiefs, which is a big deal because, I mean, look, the Chiefs 1 point win today when they're getting 8 points from Berry on the pick six and the pick two. Last week they get the safety followed by the Tyreek Hill touchdown return on the safety punt off, which, I mean, that's 9 points in a game that they ended up winning on the last play of overtime. This offense, Andy, I know you haven't had time to do the full breakdown of this Falcons game. Is this offense getting out of the woods? Because they had a really rough patch where they weren't scoring points.
Well, this is the nature of Kansas City's offense. This has been the case for the last few seasons, and now the last 2 years, ever since they started winning all these regular season games. Kansas City has an NFL high 45 takeaways coming into, I think it was 2 weeks ago. I remember it because I wrote the Chiefs article a few weeks ago. So they've led the league in takeaways. Their points off of takeaways, they had 90 points off of turnovers, off of those 45 turnovers. A lot of those were direct points. Since then, those numbers have only gone up. You mentioned the Denver game, what happened with Eric Berry today. No team in the NFL, with the exception, I believe, of Carolina, and maybe that's changed now, but no team in the NFL gets more from its turnovers and more from its defense scoring-wise than Kansas City. And their special teams also contribute a lot. So electrifying special teams, playmaking defense, and that's the end of the discussion there about what the Chiefs' offense is. The Chiefs know what their offense is, and they do have a game manager quarterback, and they call the game accordingly. And why wouldn't you? Because you're built like this. You've got a defense that wins it. It's working for them.
Yeah, I should also mention they had a fake punt touchdown today. So 29 points, but 13 of them came from the offense. 12, they had an extra point, and then they had an extra point blocked. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, when you get into the postseason, is this an offense that can score enough points? I guess that's the question we're asking right now. We saw them sort of puttered out in New England last year, that game at Foxborough.
Yep, they did. They bumped into a more talented Patriots team, and this is what we're going to be wondering again. And this gets to the heart of all football discussion in the league, is can you build a team this way? A lot of people will watch the Chiefs very closely. People were inspired by Denver last year because Denver said, hey, you can build a team without a huge quarterback in this day and age. Kansas City's following that same model. It wasn't enough a year ago, and it'll be fascinating to see if it's enough now, because it's harder to create these turnovers and flash plays in the postseason when you're at Foxborough and you're facing Tom Brady, or you're facing Andrew Luck in the first round, or whatever, Ben Roethlisberger. They're going to have to beat one of those guys, probably two of those guys. And what happens then? And that remains to be seen. They did it today, though. Against another very good quarterback in Matt Ryan.
Well, they did. Yeah, they have 7 offensive touchdowns in their last 4 games now. I don't know. Just not a whole lot. Andy, before we move on to topic 3, I have a quick plea for our listeners. I know a lot of you out there are probably fretting about what you're going to get your podcast host for Christmas this year, and I'm half Jewish, so you have to get me a Hanukkah gift as well. But here's the deal. All Andy and I want this holiday season is for you to subscribe to this podcast, the 10 Things Podcast. And if you are subscribed on iTunes, please leave a review, 5 stars preferable. But we'll even take lukewarm. Reviews help other people find the show. And frankly, that is one of our goals. We want to do a good show, and we want people to listen to it. That's all I had.
Number 3.
So we'll jump on to topic 3. Right now, and that is the Rob Gronkowski-less New England Patriots. Not a lot of trouble today with the increasingly hapless Rams coming into Foxborough. But Andy, you had a very close eye on this one. What did you think of the Gronkless Pats?
I think they look like the same Patriots, and that was what I expected. We all agree what Gronkowski is. He's the top shelf of all superstars, regardless of how many other stars are on the shelf. He's on it. There's no debating that. Having said that, it's one of the unique situations where whenever guys get hurt, Gary, I think what we want to look at, the tendency to say, oh, a superstar guy is out, well, they're screwed. That's it. But so often it is next man up in the NFL, and the next man's just not going to be as talented as the guy before him. But where the difference lies in injuries is not who's getting hurt, it's how those guys are used. And does the guy that replace you, can you do the same stuff stylistically with him that you do with the other guy? Or do you have to change your identity and change your style to accommodate the absence? And with Martellus Bennett there, the Patriots can still do stylistically everything they did with Gronkowski. Yes. They're not going to have to change who they are. And they also have become more of a three-receiver offense anyway, because they never really got this full two-tight-end thing going. Gronkowski wasn't there early in the season. Bennett wasn't there at all last year, and it's largely the same team or the same approach this year as it was in 2015. So they've become a three-receiver offense anyway, and as long as they have one movable, flexible tight end, then they can still run all of their formations and create all of their matchup problems that they would have with Gronkowski. They're just a little bit easier to defend at that tight end position, but that's not that as big a deal as it would seem, because where they beat you is how they use their running backs and their wide receivers based off of the tight end matchups. It's all about if this guy's here, that guy's there, there's our mismatch, that's how they play, and there's nothing that changes about that with Gronkowski out and Bennett in.
So my question would be, you've taken with Gronkowski out, you've taken away the biggest mismatch threat in that offense. Can you just start manning up? I mean, Julian Edelman he's going to separate, but you know, these guys, Amendola, Malcolm Mitchell, they're not guys that really strike fear into you as far as basically putting them in single coverage goes.
Right.
Do you just start playing these guys man, and can you slow this offense down doing that?
That's a great point, because the one area where it does make a difference is in straight man-to-man coverage scenarios. Gronkowski is the guy that nobody had an answer for. Bennett's a tough guy to answer for, but he's not Gronkowski like that. So
yeah,
they don't have anyone that can win on their own in man-to-man in theory. But what they do have is they're extremely well-coached and well-quarterbacked, and no team does a better job with its spacing and rub concepts and motion and stack releases where one receiver lines up behind the other and they come off the line. All of those are tactics that inherently force man-to-man defenders to back off. So if you're willing to take the 5 to 6 yard completions, which Brady is, in fact, they lead the league in yards after catch this year because they throw so many short catch and run balls. They've done a tremendous, unbelievable job of building an offense that still gets those passes to work against man coverage. They'll back you off. And really, yeah, the only team that's been able to counter them was Denver in the AFC Championship. And Denver's unique because they happen to have three of probably the league's 10 best pure man-to-man cornerbacks and one of the league's best man-to-man safeties in T.J. Ward, and good linebackers too. So, but other than that, there hasn't been a team that can just man up and out-physical those guys. So I don't think it's a big deal, Gary. I think New England will still run. They don't look any different without Gronkowski. And the other thing to keep in mind is Deion Lewis is back, and he's not Gronkowski. He's not like the Gronkowski of running backs, but he creates the same dilemmas for a defense in that, how do we match up to him? Because what do you do when he goes to the slot, or he goes in motion, or out wide? You have to have an answer for all that, and there aren't good answers. Either you play zone, which if that's the case, then those wide receivers stay inside when Lewis is outside, and now you got wide receivers going against linebackers.
Yeah,
if you play man-to-man, who goes on Lewis? Because whoever it is will probably have to follow him out wide and essentially play cornerback, and that guy's not going to be a cornerback. He's not going to have experience playing that style of football. So they still have mismatch-making pieces. As long as Lewis and Bennett are on the field together, this team is every bit as difficult to defend as they were with Gronkowski.
It's very disappointing for anyone who does not live in the 6 New England states to hear that.
What are the 6 New England states? I know Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts. Is Maine part of that, or is that too far
Maine,
north?
Absolutely. Maine is absolutely part of it. And what did we say? Did you say New Hampshire? You said four. Wait.
I said four, and I'm asking you, what are the New Hampshire, and then what's
Maine, Vermont. New Hampshire, Vermont.
Okay, there it is.
Massachusetts, Vermont. Connecticut, Rhode Island.
Yeah.
I feel like you said an extra one. I feel like you said Wyoming or something.
Yeah, no, I did say Wyoming. Yeah, that's not that was not right.
That wasn't a good guess at all.
No.
No. That's out by you, Andy.
Yep.
I have two more things I want to ask you about this game, though. Well, actually, one more thing I want to ask you, and that is Jeff Fisher got his extension. He is there for two more years on his deal. Did, you know, this got Twitter all up in arms and everyone points and laughs and all that, but did you have a problem with this extension?
No, I guess not. It's a little bizarre that we
the timing's weird.
The timing's weird, and we don't know what the timing is. We've heard conflicting reports, and no one's saying anything, and I don't understand what that's about. But people like Jeff Fisher within football. It's a little bizarre just because, and I don't know Jeff Fisher, and I think his teams have looked well coached, and I think there's I trust the respect that people have for him within the league. He's been to the playoffs six times in 22 seasons now, and yet he's a guy where the attitude about him is he'll never be unemployed. He's always, you get Jeff Fisher available, and I don't understand what that's about, but people within football hold him in very high regard. I know that.
Yeah. Now, I didn't mind it just because I think once you get Goff in there, just give Goff as much continuity for the first couple years of his career as you can. So I think once they kept him last year, I think you got to keep him for a handful of seasons here.
And
but yeah,
really,
he's
to wrap it up on the Rams, because you mentioned Goff, it doesn't matter who's coaching that team and who's quarterbacking that team until that offensive line gets better. They just cannot function with the group they have in there now.
Yeah.
And it's too bad because they've drafted some of those guys very high and they've invested in them. And they're going to have to just eat that. They're going to have to let the ship sink because it's sinking whether they want it to or not. And that's unfortunate. But until that gets fixed, everything else we talk about with the Rams, Todd Gurley, Goff, it's all academic.
Yeah, yeah. One more note from this game. I shouldn't have said I had another question. I have one more note from this game. That is Tom Brady, career win 201. He is the QB wins king.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to have more arguments about whether Brady is the greatest of all time or not, that is one more fact that you can throw to back up your argument.
And he'll be adding to that one for several years still. That's the jaw-dropping part of it, is he might wind up with another 75 wins. I mean, that would not be unheard of. That would be unheard of. That would not be a huge shock.
It's good living. It's that avocado ice cream and hanging out with Giselle. The guy's just not aging.
Number four.
Let's go on to topic four. And this is another Raiders comeback win. If you're a Raiders fan, you're obviously excited that your team is 10-2, but every game this team plays, it feels like you've just watched like three games. It feels like you watched like a huge portion of the season, because the roller coaster ride, the ups and downs are just unbelievable. And this was another one where they fell behind early against the Bills, and then they came back, and you know, by the beginning of the fourth quarter, they were up significantly. And you know, if you tuned in late, this looked like one that was a comfortable win, but it was, you know, kind of like last week with the Panthers. It was anything but. But yeah, this Raiders team, they're sitting at 10-2 now. Another nice day for Derek Carr. I mean, where do you put this Raiders team in the pecking order? And you know, is the AFC road to the Super Bowl through the AFC would go through Oakland if the season ended today? Correct? Am I right about that, Andy?
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe not. We have to see, because New England's up there with them as well.
Yeah. And I saw that the Raiders would have the tiebreaker. There's so many. I don't know what the tiebreakers are. But I'm just going to say,
four games left, so tiebreakers really matter on the last. I mean, we can't even talk about them until enough games go through, because there's too many variables when you get to those kind of tiebreakers.
Well, I'm talking the hypothetical world where the season just ended.
Yeah, I know you love to do that.
I do
really
love those
worlds.
Really
convenient for some of the stuff we talk about.
But if the Patriots have to go west to Oakland, I mean, is this Raiders team, are they in a position to knock off the Patriots, to knock off the, well, they've knocked off the Broncos, we've seen that, to knock off the Chiefs? That's a test they'll have. They did not look good against the Chiefs at home. They'll have a chance out in KC Thursday night. Really glad that game is Thursday night, because Thursday night football is always, you know, everyone puts out their best. So glad the NFL could get that set up. But, yeah, this Oakland team, are they, I don't know, are they Super Bowl material?
The offense absolutely is. And when you have a quarterback that can make any throw, then you become a team that can be competitive at any point in the game. They're built to come back because they've got a quarterback that can make the tight window throws. And they have playmaking receivers, and they're very well designed and schemed, and they win through play design at times. So the offense absolutely is. The defense is what makes me a little unsettled, specifically the secondary. They have the right pieces there. It's a matter of how the pieces perform each week. And DJ Hayden, for example, and he's out now, but DJ Hayden's a great example where he's a nice talent, but all season long you've seen a number of plays where the technique breaks down. It's sloppy plays and there's penalties and that kind of thing. It feels like there's too many DJ Hayden type plays in that secondary. So can TJ Carey improve that slot position? What do you get from Sean Smith? Carl Joseph's a rookie. He gets better by the week, but he's not lighting the world on fire yet. And then those linebackers become the X factor as well, because Malcolm Smith's been better in coverage the last several weeks, but he was lost at times early in the season. And what comes back to get you? There's too many cases on film right now where the Raiders defense, you can see ways to beat them. So the question is, are they going to be better later in the year, or are they going to keep falling for some of the same concepts? Because the really well-designed offenses, and we'll get a good feel for it Thursday night. It's too bad that game is a short week, because we're talking about two really well-coached teams. Maybe that makes it more entertaining, I guess. I don't know, but I'll be really interested to see how Kansas City attacks Oakland, because Kansas City is one of those teams that will find your liabilities and build plays specifically to exploit it.
Now, I'm excited that there will be something good to watch on Thursday night, but I am furious that, you know, the game that's going to decide the AFC West is going to be played on that, you know, crappy Mickey Mouse schedule. But Khalil Mack got it going again today. He had a strip sack that he recovered himself that sort of sealed this one, and I don't know, Khalil Mack doesn't get enough sacks, I guess, was always the criticism. But he's up to 10 now in 12 games, and you know, going way back to August when we did that special issue of Sports Illustrated with the MMQB takeover issue, and the cover story ended up being that, you know, sort of rise of Khalil Mack versus rise of Jadeveon Clowney, and sort of, you know, how much did their backgrounds, one guy being unheralded recruit, non-recruit, I should say, and one guy being the top high school recruit in the nation for 2 or 3 years, how did that affect the way the players they grew into? And we got a lot of feedback on that, saying Clowney's going to be the better player anyway. And it's just, I thought it was madness back then, and God, I just can't imagine if you were redoing that draft today, I don't see how you could possibly argue Clowney over Mack at this point, which is fine, and teams miss ever so slightly at the top draft anyway, and Clowney's going to be a good player, but I don't know how anyone can say Khalil Mack is not one of the two or three most valuable front seven players in football right now.
He is to me. I would put Clowney in that top 10 for sure after this season, though. Clowney has become this year what we were hoping he'd become, and he's now starting to play multiple positions. I know he didn't play today at Green Bay, but he has played defensive end. I think he's best as a defensive tackle type, a guy that comes out of a three-point stance inside. He's started to play outside linebacker at times. They've moved him around on their amoeba fronts, which they do a very good job with there in Houston. So I understand the value of Clowney, and I kind of understand I'm on your side on this. The people that say, well, Clowney will be the better guy anyway, because when you say that, regardless of how much you like Clowney, there's an inherent part of that statement that is a shot at Khalil Mack, And you're right. Mac is a guy you just can't take a shot at. He's a very good football player. He's not just a sack guy, which obviously he's not just a sack guy, because the gripe about him was he didn't get enough sacks.
Yeah.
But he impacts the game in so many different ways when you put on the film, whether it's the guys he's blocking or guys who are blocking him, rather, what he does against the run, his play recognition, which has gotten very good. We saw the pick six against Carolina at the end of the half last week. Yeah, Khalil Mack's right up there, and he ought to be in the – I don't think you put him in defensive player MVP discussions, I guess, because Oakland's defense has not been dominant. But he is as valuable as any defensive player in the league. He's not going to get the votes, but he is that valuable.
If you're enjoying this podcast, then check out the Seth Davis Podcast.
Michigan State basketball coach Tom Izzo on what he describes as, quote, the evils of social media.
I truly in my heart believe it's hurting my kids. I believe it's hurting my players. I believe it's hurting our society, because we're allowing people to just throw things against the wall and they're hurtful.
Remember to subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes of the Seth Davis Podcast wherever you download your shows.
Number five.
All right, topic five, Andy. This was a game that you had a close eye on. This was the Cardinals getting a win they needed to have. They beat Washington down in the desert. David Johnson doing all sorts of stuff, kind of like he always does, but let's talk a little David Johnson in this one. You know, coming into this year, I wondered how he would hold up over an entire season, because he kind of came on in December last year. He had played sort of a kick returner and sort of was sort of a deep reserve on offense and just didn't have a lot of wear and tear when he sort of had his late season breakout. But, I mean, he's been largely unstoppable in 2016. I don't know. Carson Palmer's had his issues. Is Johnson going to be enough to sort of carry this offense into the stretch run here? And the Cardinals are still, they're still there. They're still alive as far as the wild card hunt goes.
Yeah, the win today moves the Cardinals to 5-6-1. So they are on the cusp of that, on the outside looking in, but at least they're near the building, I guess.
Yeah.
Palmer played better today, by the way. And if he doesn't play better, then the discussion's off. David Johnson, whatever. Palmer has to be a tight window, sharp, precise, deep intermediate passer for them to be who they want to be in Arizona. And that's what he was today. He hasn't been that too often this season, and it's going to be tough to sustain it, because that offensive line, that's one of the few teams in the league that's really built system-wise to not withstand offensive line injuries. Palmer can get the ball out, but they're a five-step to seven-step drop-back type of team often, and they asked those offensive linemen to block one-on-one. So they got away with it today. They did all right. There were still some tough moments. But it's a tall order. But the guy that does offset some of those issues is David Johnson. So Palmer's important player number one. Johnson's still important player number two because of what he can do in the passing game. And then he does create his own yards. He has – is there anyone in the league that has a better lateral jump cut right now than David Johnson? I'm trying to think who might. Maybe Le'Veon Bell.
Le'Veon Bell, I was going to say, yeah.
And Johnson's is so powerful, though. He's a big, thick guy. And when he jump cuts, he doesn't lose any of that. He instantly regains his balance. His heels get right back into the ground, and his power maintains. And we saw that in several of his plays today. He became – Gary, he had his 100-yard game for the 12th time in a row this week. That's only happened three other times since 1960. And one guy – did it twice. One guy of this era. Can you believe that? And B, who would you guess that one guy is?
Adrian Peterson would be the.
Well, it's 100 yards from scrimmage. It's not 100 yards rushing. 100 yards from scrimmage.
Oh, from scrimmage.
So think good runner, good receiver type.
Marshall Faulk.
Yeah, that's a good guess. It's the guy who replaced Marshall Faulk.
Edgerrin James.
Indianapolis. Edgerrin James.
If you gave me a second guess, well, I guess that would have been third guess. I was going to say Edgerrin James.
And two is more than, two is, we started at one. So two. David Johnson, and he's had to create a lot of those own yards, too. There's another name. I think if I had a vote for first team All-Pro running back, let's say Arizona stays in this, and maybe they don't make it, but they're 7-8-1, 8-7-1, something like that. They're still in it in theory. I think I go David Johnson, first team All-Pro running back, ahead of Ezekiel Elliott and ahead of Le'Veon Bell this year.
All right. I think it's easy to make the Bell argument just because you could say, well, Bell set out the first three games of the year. But
no, I think Johnson's been the most valuable running back in the NFL this season.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. And I don't want to get into the whole we talk about the Cowboys every week, and we talk about how good their offensive line is. So, and I feel like we're constantly, I don't know, cutting down Dak and Ezekiel, who are both wonderful players. But, yeah, I think I'd agree with that David Johnson assessment. But looking at the other side and the other team that played in this game, all these sideline shots of Jay Gruden during this game, he looks so miffed. He looks so just, I don't know, about to blow his top. And after the game, this is, I'm reading this off of ESPN's report here, defensive end Chris Baker, "This is the hottest I've ever seen him," referring to Gruden. "He has every right to be mad, as he is, because we're too good for this, et cetera." Gruden was still fuming a little bit at the press conference. Said press conferencey things. I'm not going to bother reading this because it all... I just can't get into character. I can't get in my angry Jake Gruden character right now. But, Andy, yep, when you watch this game, I mean, look, going to Arizona, that's a tough place to play. It's a tough place to win. They were right there. Washington was right there with a chance to win this. Did you see anything from them today that would make you say, this is troublesome?
No, not really. They didn't play their best game. But when I see something that's troublesome, I say, oh, that's a liability they can't do anything about. Or that's just an egregious poor performance, and there's no excuse whatsoever. I didn't feel this one was egregious. Now, Jay Gruden knows what they're supposed to be doing. He knows what the calls are. I've heard, I think some of it was he wasn't thrilled with how the week of practice went either. And so who knows what he's upset about. But I don't think you need to sound the alarm in Washington. It wasn't Kirk Cousins' best game. They didn't have Jordan Reed, although Vernon Davis played very well in his stead. It wasn't the greatest of games for Washington, but Arizona, I felt, won this game more than Washington lost it.
Okay.
The difference in the game, just take it, the difference in the game was Carson Palmer made a handful of decisive and deciding throws.
Yeah.
Number six.
Well, let's go on to topic number six, and we are talking more running backs. Lots of safeties and running backs. Some underappreciated and, frankly, underpaid players in this league. But Le'Veon Bell, big day carrying the Steelers to the win over the previously red-hot Giants. Bell ended up going, let's see, it was 29 for 118 on the ground. And then, as always, big roll in the air, 6 for 64. So that is 35 touches, and that is a whole lot of touches in this day and age.
That is.
Yeah, this was a 24-14 final. It was not quite that close. It was sort of a sloppy game. Lots of turnovers going back and forth. Giants kept on getting short fields, and they kind of looked like the Giants of the early part of the season, where they just couldn't get it done in the red zone. But let's talk about Le'Veon Bell for a minute here. You know, Sammy Coates has the broken hand, and that's making him even worse at catching the ball. And, you know, Steelers, they're just a little bit shorthanded. We saw a little bit more from Ladarius Green today, and that's what they signed him for this past offseason, and it looks like he's sort of getting into the fold here. But they don't quite have the passing game weapons that they had that they especially with Martavis Bryant last year. Is this sort of a same question as with Johnson? Is this going to be sort of Le'Veon Bell's offense going forward? And if so, is that a good thing for Pittsburgh? Or is this sort of we can't do what we want to do in the passing game, and we're going to see if this works?
Well, it could be a little bit of all the above. Bell, this kind of spins a lot of our discussions back into this one. So we talked about David Johnson creating his own yards. Bell has the ability to do that. He's also he has a better offensive line, no question, than Johnson does. And,
yeah,
and he does a very good job of using those blocks. And if you rush, how many yards did you say he rushed for today, Gary?
He had 29 carries for 118.
So that's a sustained. What was his longest rush of the day? Do you know?
19.
So that's a sustained rushing performance.
It absolutely was.
If you can do that against the New York Giants, that front four in New York with Jason Pierre-Paul and Olivier Vernon on the edges and then Damon Harrison and Jonathan Hankins inside, that's the best run-stopping front four, pure run-stopping we're talking. That's probably the best one in the NFL. So if you can sustain offense against that, that means your blockers were winning just enough in the trenches and your running back's using that and probably doing a little bit on his own. That is a tip of the hat type of performance right there. So
yeah.
Bell's a sustained rushing attack, but the other part that I was saying, we circle these conversations back into this, is what we talked about with Deion Lewis and how he can line up anywhere, and what do you do when he splits out and goes to the slot and goes out wide? Well, actually, David Johnson presents that same issue, and so does Le'Veon Bell. And the difference with Bell and it's not the difference. You have Carson Palmer, and you have Ben Roethlisberger, and then Lewis has Brady. So you've got veteran quarterbacks, and when you have a running back that can go out wide or to the slot or move around, that gives the quarterback valuable information about the defense, because the defense has to tip its hand in how they line up. For example, if a linebacker follows the running back out wide, you know right there it's man-to-man coverage, because you're not going to put a linebacker out wide in zone coverage as if he were a cornerback. You're not going to do that. So just getting that kind of information for those QBs, letting them research the defense, that's hugely valuable. And I've noticed the way they use Bell in Pittsburgh, a lot of times in crucial moments, he'll line up on the same side of the field as Antonio Brown, and that's going to put a lot of stress on the defense. Now you're talking about the most dangerous receiver mixed with that ultimate matchup piece. So Bell's extremely valuable just because he presents that threat in that dimension. Whether the stats capture it or not is almost second rate in here, this discussion.
Yep. And look, the Giants, they actually lost Jason Pierre-Paul during this game, had a groin injury and missed about half of this one. But, yeah, it was still a very big day for Le'Veon Bell here. And they had only one player had a rushing attempt outside of Bell for the Steelers, and that, of course, was Landry Jones taking the final kneel down. So, yeah, Bell had basically all 29 of their rushing attempts.
That's one of the benefits of getting suspended. He is in
fresh legs.
October, early November type of mode right now.
There you go. Other side of the ball, I mean, look, there's been a lot of talk about the Giants. They were on that win streak coming in, and this is a team that, I don't know. I don't want to make any accusations here, but their six straight wins were home over Baltimore, L.A. out in, they beat the Rams out in England, home against the Eagles, home against the Bengals, home against the Bears, and at Cleveland. That was not really a murderer's row. It's good to get right in those games, but I don't know. They kind of ran into a good team today, and they have some good ones coming up. And
the teams,
I know what you're
going to
say, Andy. Wins over NFL teams are wins.
That's exactly right. They're all hard. And the teams you listed, with the exception of Cleveland, those are all plus defenses. Those are top 12 caliber defenses there too. They didn't face that caliber of a defense in Pittsburgh today, although it's one capable of being at that caliber on any given week. So I'm not going to cheapen the Giants' wins because their style points haven't been good or because of who they played against. Unless they're getting their wins over Carroll College or Tulane or something like that, I'm not going to worry about the strength of schedule.
Why you got to bust on the American Athletic Conference? Tulane beat my UConn Huskies late in the year. I'm still pretty bummed about it.
How did you even have something to say about it? I can't believe you had something to say about that. What about
AAC forever?
University of Montana. If they're not getting their wins over Montana, then it's the schedule is not a concern to me.
By the way, that was the Jeff Fisher comment about Carson Wentz. If he's so good, why can't he beat Montana? That was the flippant remark he made to. He wasn't disrespecting Wentz, but a fan who told him to draft Wentz, North Dakota State guy, said draft Wentz, he's going to be great. That was Fisher's comment. If he's so great, why can't he beat Montana? Lots of Jeff Fisher on the show today, too. Now, this Giants offense, they had a lot of the same problems that they had early in the year. Really bad in the red zone. Their one touchdown before this one was out of hand was actually it was a little screenplay with a blatant hold on the play that was right in the open field. And it was not called, and you will not believe who executed that blatant hold. It was Eric Flowers.
Oh, well, so he got his hands on somebody at least.
He did. He also had a hold in the end zone that led to a safety.
Oh, is that how they got
kind
that
of
safety?
Kind of a shaky call, though.
Eric Flowers has had a very tough season, and here's his deal, and then we can wrap up Giants, right? Eric Flowers has a tendency to lower his head and bend at the waist when he's initiating contact, and that is exactly how not to block. You get no power that way. You also have the little simple problem of you can no longer see anything around you because your head's looking at the turf. That's his deal. And I always look at him early in games when I watch the film, because when you watch the Giants, you need to know, okay, what are we getting from Eric Flowers today? What kind of Eric Flowers game is this? He's a real problem at left tackle, quite frankly.
Yeah. No, look, it was James Harrison coming at him on the safety.
A guy who plays low to the ground. Yep. A low to the ground player.
This is not going to end well. And he sort of held his head more than anything else. He sort of like grasped his helmet because James Harrison was too low. But yeah, that's how it went down. And if you're into the whole drama of it, Odell Beckham very upset with the officiating, and Eli Manning took a mini shot at the officiating after this one. They were not happy with it. It was a poorly officiated game, but they played very poorly. This was a legitimate loss for them.
Number 7.
But let's jump on to topic number 7. And this was the game that you and I were so excited about because we thought it was going to be a fantastic display of running and run defense and just some old-fashioned football. This was the Ravens ended up just destroying the Dolphins in Baltimore. And this was Joe Flacco going with the air raid thing. This looked like an old, I don't know, Warren Moon highlight reel or something, or something out of the Big 12 this season. Ravens just put this one out of reach immediately, and it was just not a competitive game. I don't know, Andy, have you been seeing... We've talked about the Ravens' odd refusal to establish the running game, and this was one where they jumped out to a big lead and still didn't really try to establish the running game. Are you seeing a lot of better stuff out of Flacco the last couple of weeks? I mean, they Breshad Perriman had a nice long catch-and-run touchdown in this one. Steve Smith is healthy, so they got some weapons. Dennis Pitta had a big day today. Is this passing game making major strides here?
Well, Perriman played better last week, I know.
He's definitely getting better.
Yeah, he's not playing as much, so I don't know if the coaches completely agree with us or not, but I thought he made a number of nice plays and had opportunities and capitalized on them against Cincinnati. The thing with this offense, we have talked about running the ball and how important it is that they be balanced so they're not putting too much pressure on this on their passing game. But Flacco also has to play with discipline. He has been undisciplined in the pocket far too often this season, mechanically and decision-making wise. And there's no excuse for that at all. His protection's been good enough. He just hasn't been as good of a quarterback this year. Now, that can he's at a point in his career where that can change at any time, and he could go on a hot run. And I think, Gary, if this offense can play, we don't have to say they play like they did today, but if they can play within that realm, within that region, and be a sustainable offense, this team is a serious threat in the AFC because quietly their defense is getting better each week. And we know their fronts. I think people are starting to be aware of their front seven and how good they are against the run, and the numbers back that up, so people have every reason to be aware. But I think they're getting their secondary figured out there as well, with Ladarius Webb moving around a little bit more. Weddle's been on the team all season long, so he's got to be that much more comfortable. And Jimmy Smith's going to be healthy and stay healthy, let's hope. And this is a very dangerous team. This is one of those – they'll probably be 10-6 when it's done. They'll probably win the AFC North at that record, something like that. They're going to be that team you don't want to face in the first round.
Well, listen, it's absolutely team – you know, people dismiss this team because they, you know, they won the 3 to start the season, and there were 3 ugly wins, and then they lost 4, and everyone just sort of, you know, decided that this was a – subpar team. But you know, you're seeing it, like you said, the secondary is better, the front seven is great, and the offense is starting to come together now. And you know, I enjoy seeing Perriman out there, and he doesn't play as much as it seems like maybe he should, And I'm still not used to, like, when he makes a catch, I'm still kind of like, wait, who is that for a second? Because he's a big dude, too. Yep. And you kind of forget that. But, yeah, his catch and run today, it's like he made the catch, and it was kind of like, that's a big guy. Is that a tight end? And he just took off, and it's like, oh, right, there's the 4.25 speed or whatever yep. he has. So it's nice to see him get going. The problem for the Ravens is going to be they have to go to Foxborough, and they have to go to Pittsburgh. And then they have to go to Cincinnati, and the Bengals might have A.J. Green back. And while they might be out of it, it might be nice for them to ruin the Ravens season, Week 17. So.
Well, you know, in Baltimore, that team's about winning Super Bowls and moving along. So if they're gonna have to beat those teams in some fashion anyway. So if they don't do it in the regular season, it's not just a team that's looking to get in the playoffs. They're about winning Super Bowls there in Baltimore. That's how ownership understands it. That's how the front office runs it. That's the expectation. So whoever they play, that's who they got to beat.
Well, look, they always give the Patriots a interesting time up in Foxborough, and that will be next Monday night. So keep
Thank
an eye on
goodness,
that one.
A Monday night game that like you can spend the day looking forward to. Feels like it's been 10 years since we've I guess the TV deals aren't getting done till 2020 again, but I would like them to see some kind of flex with Monday where at least you can flex these games maybe 3 or 4 weeks out in advance, because there's just been way too many boring, anemic Monday night matchups. And we have another one this week with Jets and Colts.
Yeah. Oh, my brother accepted tickets to that game back in like July, and he is regretting it right now.
Accepted ticket. That sounds like he got him for free at least.
No, he had a buddy who was like, hey, I got Colts Jets. You want to come? And he was like, yeah, sure, whatever. And now it is time to pay the price, as they say. And he is going to have to go out to East Rutherford instead of being in his fantastic Manhattan apartment or playing in our Monday night pickup basketball run. But that's his loss.
Number 8.
All right, topic 8. This was the Lions winning a game where they didn't fall behind or need to come back in the fourth quarter. It was strange things down in New Orleans. But yeah, Detroit, comfortable win, and it looks like they are, look, they're going to win the NFC North, it looks like. I mean, 4 weeks to go, but this was their most impressive beginning-to-end performance of the season. You know, they shut down a red-hot Saints offense, and... Yeah, I don't know. I guess it's time to stop doubting the Lions.
Yeah, they look like a complete team. And they have. I think Matthew Stafford's had as good a season as any quarterback in the NFL this year. I would put, if we can make bold statements, Gary, I would put Stafford and the MVP discussion. I'd put him up there with Brady and Russell Wilson and Andrew Luck.
I would go so far as to say I think it's a two-man race between Stafford and Brady at this point.
Do you really? Do you think voters
if nothing
will think
insane
that way?
Happens the last four games? I think you just have to discount Wilson too much because of, you know, his struggles early in the season. It was because of the ankle injury and then the knee problem, but you know,
I think
Wilson still
struggled
that
much during this early in the season.
The offense struggled. I'll say that. The struggles weren't his fault, but they were still struggles nonetheless. I mean, Matthew Stafford has been doing this with, you know, rebuilt line and you know, they've had these basically no actual running backs. Theo Riddick's been doing most of their work out of the backfield, and that's not much of a running game. And rotating all these receivers in and out. Marvin Jones was out today. You know, you had TJ Jones out there and Andre Roberts. And, you know, he's getting it done no matter what's surrounding him. I'd say it's a Stafford versus Brady right now. Is the MVP debate.
Well, and there's going to be, if that's, there will be a chance for people to take notice because there's their schedule remaining with Detroit. They play the Bears, which that's a, at least a big market team. That's not going to be a highlight game by any means, but they play the Bears, but then they're at the Giants, at the Cowboys, and they face the Packers in week 17. So they end with three marquee games. And if Matthew Stafford has them in playoff contention and he does some of his fourth quarter stuff and, you know, maybe people will catch on, but he deserves to be in the MVP discussion. And I, one thing I like about their offense, because it's by no means an electrifying offense, and it never will be. They don't have the wide receivers for it to play that way. They're just not good enough at that position. But Riddick and Golden Tate are two guys that you need to get the ball to them in space. And yeah, they do a very good job with that. They do it with Riddick on option routes and angle routes out of the backfield, and they do it with Tate on misdirections and screens. And about 7 or 8 times a game, at least, those guys will get touches in space, and that puts a lot of stress on a defense.
Yeah, and look, Stafford had a big day statistically, threw for 341 again with a, you know, it's a rotating cast of no-names outside of Tate and Riddick in this passing game, and Eric Ebron, if you will. And the Lions defense was excellent in this one. Kerry Hyder and Ziggy Ansah getting some nice push in the pass rush. And Drew Brees had thrown a touchdown pass in 60 consecutive home games, did not throw one today, and was picked 3 times. One at the end of the game that doesn't really count, but yeah, this was they gave Brees some issues here. I thought Glover Quinn was really good in this game.
He's had a very nice season, especially in run support. And his strength is pass coverage as the last line of defense guy. He plays the seams very well, which is critical when you face the Saints because they do a lot of stuff with route combinations along the seams, and he's a good run defender. So I'm glad you mentioned Glover Quinn.
Yeah. Now, he would have been my defensive player of the week if not for the obvious pick this week.
Number 9.
We are going to move on to topic 9. I should have mentioned before topic 8, that used to be our mailbag. And we will still have a mailbag, just not in this show. It is going to be part of our second show that comes out on Thursdays, the NFL Look Ahead. That's our preview show. It's a deeper dive. I'm just going to say it's a better show. That's a really hot take, but I'm just going to say it's better than the Monday show.
It is better. It's a deeper dive into because it fits what we do, and it's a deeper dive into specific games. So if you're into football, because we try to go around the whole league here on this Monday show, and that's what you do on Mondays, and I think we do fine with that. But we love going deep into specific games and getting into real football stuff, and that's what we do on that midweek show, and that's when we'll do your mailbag questions.
Big mailbag, too. We did like 10 questions last week. So send your mailbag questions, please, 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 at Andy_Benoit, at GRambling_SI, hashtag MMQB podcast mail, or send it to talkback@themmqb.com. Send them, and we will answer them on the Thursday show. Subscribe. It'll be in your feed on Thursday around lunchtime or so if you live on the East Coast. Anyways, topic 9. That is the time now. It is lightning. It's round time. Let's do it. We got the 49ers played the Bears in a little bit of snow, and it looked like it was fun to be there. Jordan Howard had 3 touchdowns, but didn't look particularly good, but the 49ers just couldn't move the ball. I'm not sure there's a whole lot else to say about this game.
I like the Bears front 7. We've talked about that each week. I'll be eager. Well, I don't know if I'll see the film on this one or not, because that's that. So I'll tell you what, I try to see every game on film, but it's not possible this time of year. It's just not enough hours because there's no bye weeks left.
No bye week
today. I guess 2 teams were off, but the Chicago Bears home field film at Soldier Field is worse than the TV copy. So I might skip it because you don't see anything on their film anyway. And it sounds like there's nothing to see in this one. Good performance by their defense. So, and I guess we get Colin Kaepernick discussion next week.
There you go. Bengals got back on track. This was a nice game for the Bengals. It looked like this season, well, it probably is a lost season, but they beat the Eagles and beat them handily in Cincinnati. Final was 32-14, but this game was 29-0 at one point late in the third quarter. I don't know, too late for the Bengals now, Andy. It looks like AJ Green week to week, but probably late season at best.
Well, they're 4-7-1, so I do think it's too late. And really disappointing with Philadelphia, isn't it? They're now 5-7, and just like that, the Eagles are pretty much out of the picture.
Yeah. No, they are. And look, Carson Wentz had to throw it 60 times today. Their receivers, we've talked about this all year, their receivers stink. They need receivers. And that's why it's really good that they recouped that first-round pick in the Sam Bradford deal, because now they can get some guys for Wentz to throw to, and things will be looking up down the line, but certainly not today. Texans and Packers in Lambeau. This was another snow game. It was a slog. It was both sides, defensive battle. Not the most beautiful football that that you'll ever see, but the Packers end up hanging on in this one. And I kind of felt for the Texans. Osweiler, I don't know if he can do much more than he did today. And, you know, DeAndre Hopkins had a couple of drops. They just can't put points on the board. And this game was 7-0 Packers for a long time. Texans came back and tied it. And ultimately, they're just, you know, Packers put another touchdown on the board. And that was kind of it. And the touchdown came on it was a long one to Jordan Nelson where a defensive back slipped and fell down. So it was sort of it ended up being a layup.
Okay, and that happens in the snow sometimes.
It does.
I'll be eager to see this one. Houston has a very good defense. They're very hard to play against for two reasons. One is they're good out of cover four, which I know sounds very specific, but cover four is each of the back four defenders, so your cornerbacks and your safeties, they each take 1/4 of the field. It has a lot of man-to-man elements to it, and they do a tremendous mm-hmm. job out of that. It's a hard coverage to play against. Now, you can beat it with certain route combinations, but if you play it with discipline, it's a tough one to go up against. So I want to see how Green Bay does on the all 22 look against that. And then the other thing they do is they disguise very well, and they've done that more and more as the season's gone on. And why that's a factor is Aaron Rodgers, when he has struggled this year, and he has struggled, it's people like to say it's everyone else around Aaron Rodgers, and it's never him. It's him as much as it's everyone else. But when he struggles, it's always early in the down where he doesn't play with discipline early in the down. And so it'll be fun to see how he did with the nuances of the game against a defense that gives you a blurry picture early in the down. I'm very eager to see this one. Again, we say the Packers, you don't know what mm-hmm. the game was until you actually see the coaches' film, because their stats and their way they play don't always correlate.
By the way, my favorite thing, my favorite moment from this game, maybe from this entire week of games, Ryan Griffin caught a touchdown, and I'm not only happy because he's a UConn guy, but he got to do a Lambeau leap into a bunch of Texans fans who happened to be in that corner of the end zone where he scored. I thought it was
excellent.
Neat.
Good for those fans, too.
It was pretty cool. I've just never seen so many opposing fans in one section, and Griffin got to do the Lambeau leap with them. It was pretty cool. Denver and Jacksonville. Paxton Lynch gets the start for an injured Trevor Siemian and gets the first career win as a starting quarterback, although he was not very good or effective or used very heavily in this game. Lots of runs. Bradley Roby had a pick six. It was a Blake Bortles kind of day. And I have a question for you, Andy. We're all kind of assuming that Gus Bradley is going to be out in Jacksonville at the end of the season. If you were the new regime, if you are in there, if they say you are coming in as a head coach and you get full say over the roster, are you getting a new quarterback next season?
Probably not. Unless there's one I absolutely fell in love with, I think I'm looking for a coach that can really work well with the quarterback.
Okay.
Like who'd you ask? I'm the coach on the GM. If I'm the guy that gets to make decisions there in Jacksonville,
yep.
I would hire an offensive-minded coach that's going to define the career of Blake Bortles. I'd go that route next.
Okay. All right. Just curious. Tampa and San Diego. This was I feel like we're shortchanging this one. This was a really nice comeback win for Jameis Winston in San Diego, and the Bucs are very, very, very for real. We'll have to talk more about this on the Thursday show. But, yeah, Bucs are right there. They are tied with the Falcons for the lead in the NFC South. And, yeah, this is quality football being played by the Bucs.
And I got a call from Peter King this week basically telling me that my Tampa Bay Buccaneers article last week stunk. And what I did wrong with it, and he's exactly right. As soon as he said it, I thought, oh my gosh, how did I do that? But what I did wrong with it is I led off the article with a heavy emphasis on the Buccaneers chip blocking.
Chip blocks.
Yeah. So you guys talked about this around the office. Good.
I can't confirm or deny, but our Thursday podcast might have been nicknamed the chip block podcast on our dossier.
Well, I feel like I'm allowed to say it. Can I say it here? Like, I know you don't lead off a Monday morning article with that.
No, you can say it here.
I should have led with Jameis Winston, who's playing the best. He's having some stretches right now that are the best stretches I've seen him have. He's not totally consistent yet, but when he's been on the last few weeks, he's been very on. And I think the reason why, Gary, is because they've been instituting more chip blocks where tight ends, running backs are hitting defensive ends on their way out into routes. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, you shore up the protection and you also let the quarterback know the protection will be shored up. And so Winston's playing extremely well, and chip blocks fit their offensive system naturally too.
I love chip blocks. So it's why
too.
I always love Jason Avant. I love a good chip block.
Yeah, that's right. You emailed me on a Saturday night earlier this year with a Jason Avant question. And by the way, I almost emailed you this past week because I was watching, I think it was Eagles film, and I think it was, it may have been Jordan Matthews, somebody, but I saw a good wide receiver chip block on film again. We don't see it as much anymore, not from wide receivers. There's
well,
too
that
many
was,
flex
that,
tight ends nowadays.
That was my Eagles theory, is they got it, since those, you know, receivers can't really catch or do that, they should have them chip blocking, like the old Jason Avant thing.
Well,
they
but if your receivers are chip blocking, if your wide receivers are chip, what are they chip blocking for? Because then who's catching the balls?
Zach Ertz and Darren Sproles.
All right. Well, but the problem with that is those guys run shorter routes, especially Sproles. And the whole point of the chip block is to give the routes time to go downfield, which is why it works for the Bucs, because they're a vertical offense.
Yeah. All right.
See, there's a chip block article out there still waiting to be written.
I love a good chip block. I liked the extra point last week. But we'll have more on the Bucs and the well, at least more on the Bucs on the Thursday show. So wait for that. But for now,
number 10.
Topic 10, the awards. Andy, offensive player of the week, who do you got?
I'm going to go Carson Palmer. I don't know his numbers. It was one of those I'm sure they were very good. It was one of those performances, though, that transcended the numbers, because it's when do you get the completions and what form are they coming and what would the game have been like if you didn't get those important completions. And he had a number of big ones into tight zone windows against Washington today.
I'm going Joe Flacco of the fun and gun Baltimore Ravens. Ends up throwing for 381 in a game where they just overwhelmed the Dolphins early on with the passing game. Defensive player of the week, who you got, Andy?
I'm going to stick with Arizona again, because Calais Campbell had a bull rush on left guard of Washington, Sean Laval, that was about as pure of a bull rush as you'll see, and it resulted in a sack fumble. Campbell got the sack. Marcus Golden recovered the fumble, and to Golden's credit, he went and gave the ball to Campbell right after that. But it was a textbook bull rush, and that's not – Campbell's a big, strong, powerful man, but on that play, he got lower than Laval. So a 6'8" guy getting lower than Sean Laval, who's not a great player, and he's had issues with the bull rush as mm-hmm. well this year. But I want to mention Campbell because he I don't think he's been to the Pro Bowl. He never makes All-Pro teams, of course, and yet he's – for 5-6 years now, he's been easily one of the best defensive players in the league. He's just at a position that's loaded with other stars, but he's as good as anybody, and he's having another very, very fine season for the Cardinals.
Nice. Very nice. I'm just going to give it to Eric Berry. It was going to be Glover Quinn, but yeah, Berry just too much, scoring too many points today. So, for obvious reasons, he gets it. Special teams player of the week. I'll go first because I want to build up to yours. I'm going to give it to Randall Cobb, who had two 20-plus yard returns in that Packers win. And, you know, that was a field position game, and neither offense did a whole lot. And Cobb sort of tilted the field a couple of times and helped get that Texans offense pinned back when they really were just not going to sustain a long drive. Who do you got, Andy? Special teams player of the week.
I'm going to go Matthew Slater for the Patriots. And really, this is a little more of a controversial one, Gary, because mm-hmm. Matthew Slater did not play today in this game against the Rams. He didn't play. But that's what makes it controversial.
Is against his dad's old team, too.
Yes, very good. That's an excellent point. And how many father-son combos have made in the NFL at positions as disparate as offensive linemen and wide receiver as well?
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. Coach of the week, do you want to go first?
You can go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to give it to Bruce Arians simply for the fact that, well, one, good win and all that, but that last touchdown to J.J. Nelson, that was the most Bruce Arians thing you could possibly try to do, and it worked.
Well, because he went deep on the play when they're protecting a lead, trying to milk the clock. I will say the one thing, though, that play came at the two-minute warning. So if you are going to go deep or if you want to take a shot, that's the time to do it because the clock's going to stop anyway.
Yep.
Two snaps before that, though, I think two or three snaps, he went for it on fourth and one at his own 34 or somewhere around there, protecting a one-point lead. That's about that. I mean, that goes beyond gutsy, beyond onions. That's all of it. That's the whole human body of courage.
It was, yes, it was the most Bruce Arians drive. And, hey, maybe that's what gets the Cardinals back on track here for a big finish.
My coach of the week, I'll go Tom Cable, offensive line coach in Seattle. It's a makeshift group that they're going with, and they played a very good – they outplayed it's an underachieving group this year in Carolina, but it's still a pretty talented Panthers defensive line. Seattle, at least in the first half of that game, and especially on the ground, they outplayed those guys. And on that long touchdown run that Thomas Rawls had, Justin Britt had a tremendous block at the point of attack. Rawls made a nice cut, and they made a big deal about that on TV, and that's fine. But I thought Justin Britt's zone block on that play is what made the play.
Well, very nice. The much maligned Tom Cable. Good to see him get some love. Andy, that is our show. We're going to be back Thursday with the NFL Look Ahead show. Get it. Subscribe. It'll be in your feed on Thursday around noontime Eastern. But as for now, we just want to thank our sponsors, MacWeldon.com. Use the promo code MMQB. Get 20% off their wonderful clothes. Thank you to Matt Havia. That is how you pronounce his name, Havia. We learned that on the other side of the proverbial glass. Chris Basil as well, and all the folks at Digital Media who make it sound so good. And as always, thank you to Jeff Irwin, our researcher, for making us sound smart. Thank you most of all for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. You guys out there are the best. Andy and I want to hear from you, so contact us on Twitter, Andy_Benoit or GGrambling_SI. We're also on Facebook. Send us emails. We do legitimately love hearing from you. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB podcast with Peter King, and this podcast, the MMQB 10 Things podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts. That includes the MMQB.com, SI.com, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys on Thursday.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.